Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to one of another Yes Magazine conversations from their Breakthrough 15, articles about 15 people on their 15th anniversary of the magazine who are transforming lives and life in America. We're about to talk with Ai-Jen Poo, who is founder and director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And Ai-Jen, once again, it's wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we met last was at the Take Back the Dream Conference.
That's right.
On that panel, and I, what I was thinking about so much since I met you that day was when you think of labor union organizers, different kind of visions of people pop in your mind, and different approaches. And your approach to this, as you said in that article, is based on actually, in many ways, the power of love. Which is let's talk about that. I mean, about the power of love is not something you think of when you think of organizing unions.
Right. Well, it's a really good time to be having this conversation as we're around the Dr. King's birthday. We're very much influenced by his leadership and his approach. And he often talked about love as the most powerful force for change in the world, and we've really found that to be true. In every scenario, whether it's the love that domestic workers have for their own children that brings them to this country so that they can support them to have a better life and more opportunities, or whether it's the love that parents have for their children and the concern that they have that they're cared for, those are some of the strongest, most powerful bonds and really important context for people to really bring the best of who they are to their work and to their life. And it's a powerful source of energy for change.
So taking a few steps backwards here, the beginning of this and what led you to even begin to think about working to form this National Domestic Workers Alliance. This started, what, was it 10 years ago?
So domestic workers have been organizing for about 15 years in this round.
And so how did you...
But it's gone through many phases and iterations. The most recent wave of domestic worker organizing started about 15 years ago. And started in big cities like New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco, Washington, D.C., where women started coming together in church basements and immigrant community organizations to break the isolation they felt working behind closed doors, hidden in homes across the country. And what they found was a very powerful connection and a very severe problem of vulnerability, abuse, and exploitation. And many of them were faced with problems like not getting paid at all for the work that they had been doing or being paid late, and certainly lots of wage theft or wage violation cases where people are being paid far below the minimum wage, like $2 an hour, $3 an hour. And then there were also cases of harassment and physical violence and people confiscating passports and all kinds of situations. And what the women realized was that there was a real need to come together to strengthen the voice and bring visibility to the experiences of the workforce. And what you also started to see happening was that the workforce is growing. More and more people were working as domestic workers, which also has to do with the changes in the economy. Economists have documented well that as wealth inequality grows, so does the domestic workforce, and it has become one of the main sources of employment for immigrant women across the country, to the tune of about 2.5 million workers across the country. So there was a huge need, and women came together against all odds, broke their isolation, and started organizing. And in 2007, those organizations reached critical mass, and we decided to come together as domestic worker groups across the country and formed the National Domestic Workers Alliance. So this year is, in fact, our fifth anniversary.
And you, what's interesting to me is that, and I think that people should realize, is that you came together, if I have this right, at the U.S. Social Forum.
That's right.
That's right? Isn't that right?
That is exactly right. And it was ironic because the first U.S. Social Forum was in Atlanta, Georgia, and Atlanta is such a has such historic significance for domestic workers in the United States. It's the location of the very first washerwomen strike in 1831, and it's the place where African-American domestic workers organized and won inclusion and minimum wage laws in the 70s. So there's been several rounds of powerful organizing on the part of domestic workers where Atlanta has been a center of gravity.
And I think, I mean, those conferences that don't get much media coverage, and the fact that organizations like yours were created there with all these organizers from around the country who are domestic workers, working with domestic workers, converged together and now created this national union, that's hugely significant.
It was significant. And in fact, there were 13,000 people who attended the U.S. Social Forum from all walks of life. And so it was exciting for us to form our national alliance, but it was also exciting to be a part of what was a really vibrant coming together of social justice organizations and grassroots organizations of all types from around the country.
So one of the things that inspired you in the beginning, I read this in several places, but each time I read it, it's a different name, was the story of one woman that really got to you. It was either Alice or Lily. I'm not sure which name it was.
Uh-huh.
But could you tell that story, about how that kind of affected you and the path you've chosen?
Absolutely. And there were so many stories, and there still are stories that I hear every day that really remind me about how important this work is and how important it is in the economy and the future of this country. But Lily was brought to this country to work as a nanny for a household who had two parents working. Both worked for a corporation. I think one was a vice president. And she stayed with them for 15 years. She started working for them when she was 16 years old. And she stayed with them for over 15 years and raised three children. And during that time, when she came, she thought she was going to have access to an education, be able to go to school in the United States. And that was always her dream and her family's dream. And what ended up happening was that she was actually working around the clock, severely restricted in terms of mobility. She wasn't allowed to go out and socialize with others. She was very isolated. For 15 years, essentially worked without getting paid at all. Her employers, in fact, told her that they were sending money back home to her. They were sending her salary, her wages, back home to her family. And as time went on, she stopped hearing from her family. It turned out that the employers had stopped all communication. So she was isolated, cut off from her family, raising three children with so much love every day, and yet her own life and her own humanity was denied on a regular basis. And, you know, I think that anybody who hears that story and who meets Lily and understands that there are cases like that out there, and they're not just a case of a few bad apples, but a case of an industry and in some places of our workforce, you know, there's just it's allowed to be like the Wild West. There's no regulation, there's no protections, and so workers are really at the mercy of these acts of violation of abuse and human rights violations. And so it really reinforced for me the need for workers to organize, the need for strong protections and labor standards, and the need for voices and stories like Lily's to be heard.
Now, you worked also to pass this bill, and I'm really curious about how this has worked out. The first bill in the country in New York, it happened in New York State. It took you a long time to do it. I think it was passed, was it, in September 2010, the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights.
Yes.
And so talk a bit about that. I mean, that was a long, hard trail, but you got it done.
Absolutely. It was essentially in New York in 2003. There was a group of domestic workers who came together across different communities and challenged the city council to pass legislation to really educate employers and workers about their rights and their legal obligations, to really start talking about putting the issue of domestic workers' rights and domestic work as real work out there in the public. And we won that legislation in under a year in New York City, but what we found was that it was simply a bill to educate employers and workers about the existing laws, and that the existing laws were too limited. There simply wasn't much there, and in fact, domestic workers were excluded from almost every major labor law. And so workers decided that we need much, much, much bigger change, and that we need to establish our own labor law to make sure that our work is recognized officially and protected like any other workforce. So they called for a convention called the Having Our Say Convention, where over 250 domestic workers came together, and they identified the key pillars that would allow them to feel like they could go to work every day and receive the respect and dignity that they deserve. And that those series of conversations at that convention led to the creation of our state bill, which then domestic workers took days off from work, sacrificed days' pay to travel to Albany year after year. And it took 6 years. And I don't even know how many visits. I mean, one of our members said that she went to Albany 27 times to tell her story and meet with legislators. So that gives you a sense of how hard people work to get this done. But once we did get it done, it is the very first law in the country to extend labor rights to domestic workers, and we're currently working to do the same in California.
Now, in the law itself that you helped pass guarantees at least 3 paid days off a year, 1 day off a week, overtime pay for work weeks more than 40 hours, but is it being enforced? Can it really be enforced?
You know, this has always been the challenge. That there's a number of workforces that are hidden where enforcement is a real challenge because they're smaller workplaces. But this is something we've got to figure out, because in a lot of ways, more and more of the economy looks like the domestic work industry, where workplaces are much smaller, they're very decentralized and scattered, and workers are hard to reach. And so we've got to figure this out. And our answers so far have been to really have strong partnerships between enforcement agencies like the Department of Labor and community organizations and worker centers, our member groups, who have have their eyes and ears close to the ground. They're on the front lines interacting with workers every day. And it just maximizes everybody's potential, everybody's capacity to help make sure that people know what the laws are and people know how to assert their rights, and they know what remedies and solutions are available to them if anything were to happen.
The other part kind of is stunning in some ways is the idea that that you're building not just something around the domestic workers themselves, but the families who they work for and their families. That's something, you know, I mean, workers and bosses and organizing unions is often an adversarial process, to say the least.
Right. It's such a, in our workforce, it's really important, and the workers were the ones to really initiate this, because in many instances there are very strong and lasting bonds that get created with the families that they work with. And so they were the first to say, we've got to find a way to reach the employers. And they know that there are some employers out there who want to do the right thing. Just as every domestic worker who's been around for a while will tell you that everybody's got stories in terms of bad employer stories, everybody's also got one or two good ones at least. And so you know, when you're talking about an industry where there's 2.5 million employers and workplaces scattered around the country, there's just a real diversity in who the employers are, what they care about, how they think about the fact that they're hiring somebody to work in their own homes. And so we supported an organization to form called Hand in Hand, which is the Domestic Employers Association that believes that healthy homes and just workplaces go hand in hand. And this employers association is out there talking to employers, creating a safe space for employers to talk about their experiences as employers and beginning to encourage them to think about how they can do one step better in their employment relationship with their domestic worker, or how they can get involved in some of the advocacy. Because in a lot of ways, many of these employers see it as in their interest to have domestic workers protected and recognized in the labor law. It creates stability, it creates an improved quality of care, it creates an environment where people don't have to guess what the working conditions should be. They don't have to ask informally in secret their employers or their other friends, you know, how many sick days do you offer? There's just set guidelines there, and I think that there are a lot of employers who want to do the right thing and just really need to know what that is.
I'm curious where you think this goes, and then how you see the future going. I mean, this is for one reason is that this is one of the areas that's going to be a growth industry in America. We always talk about the high-tech industry, but at the very bottom, there are more jobs at the bottom being grown than at the top at the moment in America. And this is one of those jobs, job categories.
Right.
So how do you see this growing? I mean, how do you see this taking place over the next 10 years? Especially, you're talking about people who hire nannies, for the most part, are people who are relatively well off, or you wouldn't do it.
Right.
And their financial interests are not always the same as a poor working-class woman of color. Who would seek these jobs? You know, there's that whole mythology of, they're part of the family.
Right.
So, I mean, how do you see this thing developing from both ends, from the right to the domestic worker and this effort to kind of care across generations and bring people together from both sides?
Right. We've started to recognize that there's two resources that are vital in our economy that everything else on the economy is built on. And those resources are care work, or the work that takes place inside of homes to take care of homes and families, to make sure that people, it's the work that makes all of their work possible. And then there's also the earth and natural resources of the planet. And both of those resources have been taken for granted and made invisible. And it's led us down a path that's really unsustainable. And if we're to think about a 21st century economy that's sustainable, that works for everyone and works for the planet and future generations, then we're going to have to figure out how we recognize and protect those vital resources that we have. And in the way that we're growing as a nation and we're changing demographically, these questions are only going to become more severe. And in terms of the care side of the question, I mean, our nation is aging at an incredibly rapid rate.
Yes.
Where every 8 seconds an American turns 65. That's 10,000 people per day, 4 million people per year. And what that means in terms of the need for long-term care going into the future is really, it's just going to skyrocket. And there's going to be this gap in terms of the care that we need to make sure that all of our loved ones are cared for and the current workforces that exist. So our vision is that we actually create jobs in care work, especially in home-based care, so people can live at home and in their communities for as long as possible as they age, and be surrounded by their loved ones. And so we're talking about the tune of 2 million new jobs in home-based care, job training and career ladders, and improved job quality for those jobs, so they can be jobs that people can take pride in and support their families on. And we're talking about making care more affordable to everyone, because we recognize that really the vast majority of employers are in the 99%. And, you know, they may be coming from a different socioeconomic background than the workforce, but that ultimately, as our economy, as we enter into a deepening jobs crisis, and as wages continue to stagnate for everybody, that affording quality care is going to be an issue for more and more Americans. And in more ways than one, we are all in the same boat. And so how do we come up with win-win solutions for the future that really speak to that? And I think that our vision, and it's encapsulated in our campaign called Caring Across Generations, is one way to think about a proactive look into the future, into the kind of caring, sustainable economy that we'll need for the 21st century.
In, you know, in this kind of work that you're doing, I mean, it was very moving when I watched some of the videos that we'll attach to on the website that you I think if I get to remember this correctly, that you built out of the, use the movie Help as a way to, and the book Help as a way to kind of broaden your campaign. And bring these voices in of the children, of the women who do the work, of even the employers.
Yep.
Because what you're trying to do here is to humanize this entire effort and bring people who, as we talked about a minute ago, who one would think could be adversarial, together in building a new world.
Exactly. We often say that there's no such thing as an unlikely ally in a campaign for human dignity. And we think that that's absolutely the case, and it's been proven. At the end of the day, there's some really fundamental important things that we share: love for our families, concern for their futures. And I think that those things can be really powerful connectors as we figure out how to build the movement we need.
So one of the things I gleaned from the things I've been reading about you recently is your deep belief in the power of women.
Yeah.
As a force for change.
Yeah.
Clearly I think that's true more and more, where people are beginning to wake up to that fact, but clearly you grew up with that fact and awakened to it as a young woman.
Women's leadership is absolutely essential. I mean, I think you just see the world a lot more clearly when you see it through the eyes of women. Even just as an example, you know, in what was happening in Arizona around the anti-immigrant law that passed over a year ago,
mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of people were outraged by what was happening in Arizona and talking about it as legalizing racial profiling. And it wasn't until we started listening to the stories of women and women talking about how their children were being impacted at school, how they were afraid to go and receive the health care that they needed in the hospital, or survivors of domestic violence being afraid to call for help, resources like shelters, let alone the police, that you start to see a whole new texture and a whole new view on what's actually happening in the community. And it really deepens our understanding of what's needed to transform that and build something that's more sustainable and works for everyone. So I often feel like when you hear the voices of women and you see the world through their perspective, you can often get a much more complex and complete picture of what is the what the problems are and what the potential solutions are.
I mean, it was one of the things I read that you talk about your mother and father, your mother who both were professionals. Your mother worked all day, came home and cooked and take care of the kids. And as much as you learn from your father, who was a human rights activist in Taiwan, in China, you said he didn't realize it, but he was part of the leisure class.
That's right. And he read that article afterwards and emailed me about how he needed to reflect on that.
So I found that really
Yes, that's right. No, I do think that, you know, women's work and vision and creativity has been this invisible lot of what we are trying to do is make that creativity visible and have it really serve a vision for a 21st century economy and an America that works for everybody, where we can all live and work with dignity.
And it is complex. I was thinking about many, many years ago, a dear friend of mine who was a union carpenter, and I did organizing together, and we were friends, lived down the block. And one day we were playing a game of chess, and I said to him something about, well, I would never hire a domestic to work in my house. I think we should learn how to clean up our own stuff, is what I said to him. And he looked at me and said, but Mark, that means my mother wouldn't have had a job, and that it's an honorable profession. And it was we had this, so it was like an eye-opening thing for me.
Yep.
At that moment, you know, because the lens through which you see life, especially as defined by race and class, changes, it defines the existence in a certain way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we do think that the what we should be striving towards is a society where every job is valued and respected. And much of what we're trying to do with Caring Across Generations is actually recognize that domestic work is a profession and a career, and that there should be career advancement opportunities available as well. And so the job training programs, the workforce development programs that we're putting into place are really helping to send that message and to really help people capture the skills that they do have, that they've been developing over the years in this work.
And as we kind of launch in this 21st century, because you're young and you'll be in this for a while to come, I have a feeling, as an organizer and a fighter for human rights, this could have profound effect, I think, if it actually becomes a nationwide movement that organizes domestic workers, most of whom are immigrants and women of color, West Indian women and Latino women especially. And if it unites them with a certain body of people who do the hiring, I mean, it could force a change that'd be almost impossible for state legislatures, even a national or Congress, to resist.
Absolutely. I mean, the workforce is already a significant part of the economy, especially when you pull together home care, the continuum of domestic work and child care into home care and home health. It's a tremendous number of workers of the American workforce, and it's growing. And if we can establish recognition, protections, and if we can make those jobs quality jobs, then it's a really good sign for what we can do for the rest, for the entire workforce. I mean, historically, these jobs have been some of the most undervalued, invisible, and unrecognized and highly exploitative jobs in the labor market. And if we can turn that whole layer of jobs into quality, dignified jobs, it can have a tremendous ripple effect for the rest of the economy on every level. And so we're really excited about the relationships that we're building with unions and with senior groups and people with disabilities and family caregiver groups, to really talk about how we build a movement to make that happen, because it is in everybody's interest.
And I wonder how you see this transforming the industry itself. I just want a couple of quick thoughts here. You know, that we spend so much money in Medicare on institutionalizing older people, when most of older people and their families would love to find a way to keep people in their homes,
yeah,
to let you be as you live the final days of your months and days of your life, as you draw your last breath, to be home with people who love you.
Exactly.
And that this is part of what you're talking about as well.
That's right.
It's an economic transformation that could help save money on Medicare and give more women work and more people work and keep families whole.
Exactly. It is a win-win solution. There is what they call an institutional bias in our social programs like Medicaid and Medicare, where people are actually having to be institutionalized, and you're absolutely right. People people want to live at home and live independently and in their communities for as long as possible. That's very important to people, anybody you ask. And so, you know, and it's much more economical. It saves so much money for the entire system when people are able to stay at home as opposed to an institution. So we really want to promote the growth of the workforce that is going to support people in homes and in communities as opposed to institutional-based care.
Ai-Jen Poo is director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, also the founder of that organization, a work built on the power of love and organizing, which is probably the most powerful force, as she says, for change in our world. And Ai-Jen, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.